At this time, I would like to introduce the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Ohio, Maureen O'Connor. Maureen O'Connor's election to the Supreme Court in 2002 created its first female majority. Her election in 2010 to the Chief Justice's office gave Ohio its first female chief. This marked her latest achievement in a long and distinguished career of public service. Chief Justice O'Connor has formerly served as a private attorney, magistrate, and common pleas judge. She served as the Summit County prosecuting attorney and later as lieutenant governor, where she simultaneously served as director of the Department of Public Safety and chaired various security task forces. It's been my distinct honor to have worked with the Chief Justice the last few years. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for that warm welcome. I really appreciate that. It is really a pleasure to be here and be able to address the Ohio Judicial Conference. It is a task that is given to the Chief Justice each year, and I know our late Chief Justice Tom Moyer enjoyed it very, very much. I know, working with the same staff members, how much time and effort he put into this speech. It was, a monumental project for him. And it does prove to be kind of a daunting task to try and look back and capture some of the highlights, because oftentimes there are so many. Chief Justice Moyer used to like to also introduce a bombshell, going forward type of initiatives that we're going to. I don't have any of those today. I tell the staff that we have at the court, we have so many good things going on that we need to work on them and finish them, and then I will have fodder for the next year's speeches over and over again, because again, we have such a tremendous staff at the Supreme Court, as do you in your administration and your support staff for all the courts. I think not only are we blessed with excellent judges across this state, but we have to recognize our support staffs as well. And we at the court are no exception. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. So I want to thank the judges here. I know that you all represent the last half of the alphabet like I do. For CLE, in fact, we have justices from the Supreme Court who are with us today, many of whom are in the last half of the alphabet along with me. We have Justice O'Donnell, Justice Pfeiffer, Justice Lanzinger, and Justice O'Neill here with me. So welcome, colleagues. Last year, I spoke to you about judicial reform, and this initiative is still a priority with me, but I'm not going to talk about that today. I want to cover several other topics. You know, I'd like to add my comments to what was said by Marty very eloquently about the issue that oftentimes is the elephant in the room, and that's judicial pay. I don't have to tell you that this is the longest dry spell ever for judges not to have received a pay raise, and it is extremely troubling. And that translates into some real losses within the judicial family across this state. The issue goes beyond basic cost of living increases, which I think is the minimum that we should have been receiving, although we have not. Choosing a career in public service should not mean being saddled with a stagnant salary for the entire time or the majority of the time that you spend on the bench. This amount of time without a pay raise is far too long. The issue takes on added significance when you consider the coming turnover in the judiciary. We are a branch that is in transition. Of the 700 plus judges currently holding office, nearly 100 are in their final terms and will not be able to run again. So within the next 4.5 years, we will have a tremendous turnover. In other words, at a minimum, 14% of the current roster of judges will turn over within the next 6 years, and this number does not include the number of judges who retire early before they are aged out. In fact, since January, we have had 7 judges retired midterm. These statistics underscore the need to make the judiciary as attractive as possible to sitting judges, to keep them as sitting judges, and also to potential candidates for the judiciary. In discussions with the leadership of our legislature, we have not asked for the moon. Let me assure you that. I know that judges' salaries cannot equal or match what big firms pay. None of us would be sitting in the room as judges if that's what our expectations are or that's what we wanted, because that's not what we want as judges. Our job satisfaction is oftentimes the biggest reward, the public service element of what we do. If we wanted to be in private practice with all of the trappings of private practice, we would have been there, but we chose a different career path and one that I think we're all satisfied with. But part of that satisfaction is a fair salary for the amount of time, effort, and good that we do put into our jobs. What is being discussed is essentially with the legislature, essentially what is in place was in place in the last legislation to address this issue, and that was well before 2008. And times have certainly progressed since 2008. Modest annual cost of living increases that would keep pace with inflation is not too much to ask. Also worthy of discussion is the idea of an elected officials commission. This commission, based on study and analysis, would recommend compensation for all elected officials, not just members of the judiciary. And this is a concept that is being floated about and talked about as well. Other states have such commissions and they work very, very well. Without an effort to make judicial salaries more competitive, sitting judges will look to jump to private practice or other opportunities, and potential judges will not even give the bench the time of day or consideration. I encourage you to help make the case to your legislators and to the public when you have the opportunity to do so. I must take a moment here to commend Mark Swikert and the conference for their efforts in that area. Mark and I meet on a very regular basis to discuss not only compensation, but all kinds of topics of interest to us both. And closely related to the judicial pay issue, in my mind, in addition to judicial pay, I think hand in glove with that is the adequacy of funding Ohio courts. And that's a whole other area and topic for discussion. I think most of you know that the Task Force on Funding Ohio Courts has been gathering information from the courts through questionnaires and other documentation that we have asked for. I believe, have been recipients of those questionnaires, and the vast majority of courts have returned them as had been requested. Based on those questionnaires, it's estimated that it cost about $1.1 billion to operate the state's courts, although this is just a preliminary figure. At first glance, that may seem like a lot, $1.1 billion. But with a closer look and in comparison with other sections of government, it truly is not. Consider that Ohio's court system, as a co-equal branch of government, is funded less than the Department of Rehab and Corrections for fiscal year 2014 and 15. Theirs is $1.5 billion in GRF funding. To use another law enforcement partner budget, the Department of Public Safety's biennial budget for their 2 years equals $1.4 billion. So those are just departments within the executive branch. We're talking about the entire judicial branch receiving funding of $1.1 billion. The number represents our current best guess at all state plus local funding of the court. So this is not just what the state allocates to the court, not at all. This is the entire ball of wax when you're talking about what the local, the county, and the state dedicate to funding of the judiciary in our state. That takes on an even greater significance. What we do know without guessing is that just the state's portion of funding for courts is about $150 million. That represents less than one half of 1% of the state budget. Think about that. We're the third branch of government, and what we receive from the state through GRF for the Supreme Court, the Court of Claims, and the Ohio Judicial Conference is less than $150 million a year, less than one half of 1%. I do not know how much is spent in total on our government in Ohio. In other words, all of the legislative branches, all of the executive branches, and all of the judiciary. However, I know that the operations for the judicial branch pale in comparison to what the other branches of government receive and spend. I'm quite certain that the $1.1 billion estimate to operate Ohio's judicial branch as a percentage of total government expenditures is an extremely small number. Given the constitutional and statutory obligations required of Ohio courts and their programmatic initiatives, it's not a stretch to say, quite possibly, that Ohio courts are underfunded. I think that that is a very, very true and accurate statement. The task force that is in place will be in a better position to weigh in on that question at the conclusion of their work with recommendations. In order for the task force to complete its work, accurate reporting is crucial to come up with a solid financial number so that we can make our case. If you are one of the few courts that have not answered the survey questionnaire, please make it a priority. It is important that we get your information. As you can see, accurate data helps. It does not hurt our cause. If we are to make a case for adequate funding, we have to have that backed up with correct data. We need your data to put in the compilation so that we are able to present our case as accurately as we can. And that is just the beginning of the conversation. It will also help to build the case that the state court system is a bargain, considering the services that the judiciary provides to every citizen in every community throughout this state. Part of making the case for judicial compensation is helping the public understand what judges do, how well judges do it, and the many innovative programs that are taking place in the courthouses around this state. Here are just a few worthwhile programs and initiatives at the local level to point to. In Franklin County, under the leadership of the county prosecutor and the Columbus City Attorney, the courts, the sheriff, and the community agencies are collaborating to develop a protection order intake center. And this is a pretty exciting concept. The vision is to have a user-friendly, centrally located center that will assist the public in identifying which type of protection order they may need, which papers are appropriate in getting started, and which court they will need to contact in order to receive that order. By housing all participants in one location, citizens will be provided more efficient services and save the time and frustration of not knowing which court or which office they need to go to in order to receive their protection. This project is in the planning phase as is currently receiving assistance from the county commissioners. The initiative is believed to be the first of its kind in the state. Now, the Montgomery County Common Pleas Court is on its way to making the jury payment process self-sufficient, and this is a very, very innovative program that they have. Through cash dispensing kiosks, jurors get paid the very day that they serve. No more checks in the mail. No more burden for the county finance department. Best of all, the jurors get paid in a fraction of the time. And did I mention they receive cash at this kiosk? In Lake County Domestic Relations Court, children aged 6 to 12 of divorcing parents take a class called What About Me? To help them navigate the hurt and the uncertainty of divorce. The class focuses on activities to teach children that divorce is not their fault, that they are not alone, and to help them express feelings, and also identifies coping strategies. There are many, many more examples I could share, but please know that all of your efforts are appreciated. Whatever program you have in place locally, here's an idea. Share it. Get it out. Make it known. Talk about it. These are great, innovative programs. Make it known to your peers around the state, and most importantly, make it known to your communities. Get out there and talk about all of the great work that you do. There are so many forums that you can utilize in order to toot your own horn about what you're doing and about what your staff members are doing. Resist the monastic life and get out into your communities every opportunity that you can. Take advantage of these opportunities, whether it's a local radio program or a newspaper column or a monthly Rotarian meeting or any other service organizations' meetings, breakfast or lunch. People want to meet you. They want to talk to you about what you're doing. Give them the opportunity because you're all doing great things. Success stories go beyond the local level, and two recent statewide gatherings point to the value of judges across Ohio about learning and borrowing from each other. And these were two initiatives that were sponsored by the Supreme Court in partnership with it was the June 30th Judicial Symposium on Opiate Addiction, included judges and justice system partners from 83 counties. We also partnered with the governor's office as well as the attorney general's office and divisions and departments within the executive branch to put on this highly successful opiate addiction symposium. Data released in April by the Ohio Department of Health showed that there were a total of almost 2,000 overdose deaths in Ohio in 2012. Two-thirds of those were from opiates, and I know from our first session we really have been saturated with the discussion of opiates and heroin and drugs, and oftentimes the information that we receive today is great for understanding what is presented at the trial court, but what we're talking about here is how we're going to deal with the consequences of how you as judges, what information you need to know to deal with the consequences of this epidemic. You know, we have, as I said, about 1,272 deaths we have almost 2,000 deaths, 1,272 were from opiates. And when you contrast that just a very short period ago, in 2001, there were only 266 deaths statewide. So you know how quickly and expansively this problem has arrived. The real tragedy is that over the span of time, from 2001 to 2012, deaths rose from opiate overdoses fivefold. And we know that this is a priority with law enforcement, with the courts, with social service agencies, with the physician communities, with the hospital communities, the treatment centers, and the coming together of all of these interest groups is both remarkable and I think is going to be effective. The sad state of affairs that all of Ohio has been affected by heroin and other opiates is tempered by the fact that we have these solutions. We have these countywide solutions. They're partnering with the interest groups that I've spoken about, as well as law enforcement, and coming together to get a better handle, not only on the solutions, but the interdiction and the ability to thwart it before it begins. Many communities across the state have had or will have scheduled town hall style meetings to receive input and share promising judicial practices and options for treatment, including medicated assisted treatment. There's some pilot, I think there's five counties that are involved in a pilot project on that right now. And all that was discussed at the symposium. In addition to learning about the science of addiction, the symposium attendees also heard from addiction experts and a panel of judges running successful specialty dockets on drug abuse. And that got very high ratings in the response from the attendees on the success and the reception for those sessions. Representatives from countywide teams will be invited back in November of 14 to share their experiences as part of the Supreme Court's annual Drug Court Conference. Other support activities for our local courts dealing with this problem are being planned by the Supreme Court staff in cooperation with executive branch agencies, and I look forward to hearing about the progress on that too. We had another summit, which was highly successful, very well received, and that was the Domestic Relations Summit in April of 2014. Judges and their justice system partners were focused on minimizing conflict for Ohio children and families. Attendees completed assessment of their local case management practices to streamline, combine, or reorganize steps in the process. Following the analysis stage, teams assess their resources, which is crucial in how we solve these problems, assessing their resources to ensure that they were using them in the optimal manner. Finally, teams work to identify challenges and then solutions to those challenges. Teams also learned about promising Ohio and national practices to promote discussions on improving the case management for parties appearing before the court. presentation focused on case flow management, protecting families from abuse and dispute resolution, and teams also devoted time to facilitated planning at that summit, what they can do with their own counterparts within that county to plan for and tailor those plans to the needs of the county. You know, statewide success stories also extend to our colleagues in the bar, not just the judiciary. A total of over 3,000 attorneys reported pro bono legal services to at-need Ohioans for 2013 in the Supreme Court's annual tally. They provided more than 100,000 hours of pro bono assistance. The value of their pro bono services is estimated at a minimum, or at a minimal rate of $135 an hour to equal services of $13.6 million given to the underprivileged communities and individuals within our state. Most of the pro bono legal services were provided in matters involving family law, wills and probate, employment law, property law, including foreclosures and evictions. These results clearly show that Ohio attorneys continue to step up to provide a legal voice to those who would not otherwise be heard for problems that affect them deeply in their daily lives. Another area where Ohio will step up is through a Supreme Court task force that will identify obstacles for low-income and disadvantaged Ohioans to access our civil justice system. I don't need to tell you that access to justice is a problem that is faced nationally. The group held its first meeting on August 1st. The 11-member task force on access to justice will review how other states have addressed the issue, including permanent commissions that bring together stakeholders needed to advance and to enhance access to justice. I urge the task force to broaden the definition to not only include those who cannot afford an attorney, but also to those who encounter other barriers to the legal system, such as language barriers. The task force includes judges, representatives of the legal aid organizations, the state public defender, private attorneys, and it is being led by former Supreme Court Justice Yvette McGee Brown, and Justice Judy French is the court member who is participating in this task force as well. I'd like to mention another initiative that I think will help raise the profile of judges, and that is through the development of a voter education initiative that is being created with the Bliss Institute at the University of Akron. We have partnered with the OSBA and the League of Women Voters on this project. Through this effort, it's envisioned that the website, which will be created and hosted and managed by the Bliss Institute, would better educate voters about what judges do and why the judiciary is important to all citizens. It will provide a centralized repository so voters can gain easy access to more information about judges and judicial candidates across the state. We have been meeting regularly with our partners in this effort. The next step will be to develop a survey that will form baseline research about what voters know about judges, about the courts, and about the judicial system and the elections, so that we know how to target our efforts and we can measure results later. The ultimate goal is to elevate voter participation in judicial elections by educating voters as to what judges do and why it is important to participate in judicial elections. There's some additional interesting factoids about the judiciary. Out of 22 professions ranked by Gallup survey last year, judges placed ninth as to honesty and ethical standards for people in different fields. 45% of the surveyed respondents ranked judges very high or high for honesty and ethics. This finding is yet another positive for the judiciary, especially considering where other branches of government are linked and leveled. We are far in excess of the legislative and the executive branches, and I think that that is a credit to the men and women who are sitting in this room. By the way, lawyers place 16th, so that's not so bad. The judicial branch should be proud of successful programs and its innovative initiatives. Keep up the good work on the front end, and we're going to try to do the best job possible we can do in sharing those stories with each other and with the public. I want to talk a little bit about the internal operations at the Supreme Court at this point. We've had some changes at the Supreme Court since May. I think all of you are aware that we are without an administrative director. Steve Holland moved on to, after almost 15 years with the court, to be the administrative director at, or maybe it's the executive director, at the Constitutional Modernization Commission, and that is his new area of challenge. So we will be launching our AD search, administrative director search, this week. A screening committee will be in place to review the applications and then make recommendations to the justices so that we will do the final round of interviewing for that process. We anticipate and hope that this will begin shortly and we will have someone in place by the end of the year. Currently, Mindy Wells, who was the assistant administrative director, is the interim director. She only agreed to become interim director provided that she would not be considered to be the full-time administrative director. She does not want the job and will be returning to her position as assistant. We have a search right out there now, I'm sure many of you are aware, for director of the Criminal Sentencing Commission. Dave DeRoll is retiring and moving on. We need to find a replacement. We have 45 or 46 applications received to date. There is a screening committee that is formed from members of the Sentencing Commission, and we will start the interview process, and again, stay tuned for those results. The reporter of decisions is a job that is being under search right now. Sandra Grosko has moved on to be promotion to the clerk of courts. Sandra, you all, I think Sandra's here. There she is back there. You can stand up there, Sandra. She is our clerk of court. She is a longtime employee of the court and has occupied numerous positions, probably more so than many of the other employees. And she does a great job at each one of them, and she will now be the clerk of courts. So expect a decision on our reporter position, I would say, within the month. It may say to you, geez, there's a little bit of turnover going on at the Supreme Court. Well, yeah, there is, and it's positive, and I want to explain a little bit more about that. We have people who are leaving for retirement. We have people that will be taking advantage of the ERIP, the Early Retirement Incentive Program that we have at the court. Since May, we have promoted or provided new opportunities to 11 members within the Supreme Court staff at all levels. Promoted to professional positions, Sandra, as I mentioned, Christy Tall at the Judicial College is the interim college director. Brett Crow is the new PIO director. Tasha Ruth is manager of case management section. Our previous director of public information, Chris Davey, who many of you are familiar with, has moved on to hold a position with Ohio State University. We just couldn't compete with the money. it was kind of a bittersweet transition for Chris as well. He was really a very popular employee with our staff and with the justices. We have other professional opportunities, people from maintenance to facilities to our IT program, as well as our legal staff and our mid-level managers have all moved on to new opportunities within the court. So just since May, we have offered promotions and opportunities to 11 members out of a staff of about 250, and that's quite impressive. And that, I think, is a reflection on the quality people that we have working for us. So I'm very excited about that. Now you're going to see postings to backfill those jobs that are vacated by the promotions and the transitioning. So stay tuned for that as well. We've created some new positions, a new master commissioner's position, assistant reporter, family law case management counsel, and those positions, one is filled and the other two are in the process as well. We have a policy at the Supreme Court that our positions are opened until filled. We start interviewing at a particular date and that date is announced, but we allow for applications to continue to be filed and reviewed. So it is, I think, a more open process and one that I think is more inclusive of folks that would be interested. Our IT positions, and many of you work with our IT department, especially in the appellate division, our operations are now up to full contingency. We have only one remaining vacancy, and that for an entry-level help desk technician. And that position is being advertised, and we will fill that shortly. So I'm very excited about our IT. That is such a crucial department within our division, within our branch, not only for the Supreme Court, but the support that's given to the local courts as well. E-filing, stay tuned. It's a work in progress. We have a pilot project that is starting with some state government entities. The AG's office, I think the state public defender, and a few other folks are going to be the guinea pigs for the e-filing. And then we're going to have something that we're going to be ready to roll out in early 2015 and talk about that. That's probably more of importance to the bar, but it's something that you should be aware of as well. Something that you're all interested in is the Supreme Court case management system. We are engaging a feasibility study for standardized case management system being conducted. It will be conducted by the Gartner Group. The legislature has been generous in funding the Court Technology Fund, $3.3 million this and last year. Statewide input will be considered as part of the study following, you know, some of you have been challenged because of the abrupt exit of MCAD from the case management world and the resulting impact on our local courts. We understand the urgency and the need for a dialogue and solutions to that problem. One of the reasons why we are having this case management system overview study done by the Gartner Group is that the information that we have is about half a decade old, if not more. And we can't look at spending $3.3 million per year or anything close to that if we don't have up-to-date data and a study done about what our customers need, you being the customers. So the courts will be asked to participate in giving information, and we're going to, as we move forward, look at how we can do this. Some people call it the hosted case management system. I don't know whether that's going to be the appropriate term, depending on what we go forward, but believe me, we're dedicating time, talent, and dollars to come up with this solution. I think all of the administrative judges will receive a physical security assessment service letter within the next week or two. That is service offered by the Office of our Court Security to your local courts that will assist county and local courts in conducting comprehensive court security surveys and site surveys, assist county and local courts in the development of emergency and security procedures, provide assistance in the operational planning and coordination of high-risk or sensitive trials, provide training opportunities for court security personnel throughout the state of Ohio, and security education for new judges and their family. We have a host of individuals who have expertise in this area. Those services have been provided to many courts within the state, but there are still many that can be provided or that the needs arise, and we are there to remind you that the opportunity presents itself. We have developed a new judge, it's called onboarding process, and that's an HR word, onboarding. It's kind of like, reminds me of waterboarding, but it's a process that we have when new appointments are made, and like I said, we've got a host of new appointments, and they're appointed mid-cycle by the governor's office, and they come to the Supreme Court, and we really immerse them with a lot of information. I make every effort to meet the new judges when they're there for that day, to answer any questions they may have or just give them encouragement, but it has gotten excellent review by the judges that we have onboarded. We also, as a milestone, reached our 10th anniversary mark this year for our occupancy of the Thomas J. Moyer Ohio Judicial Center. It's still a special place. It is still, probably one of the most beautiful buildings in the state, if not the country, for housing the judiciary. I hear that from my colleagues in the Conference of Chief Justices. I hear Chief Justices encouraging other Chief Justices, if you ever get the chance to go to Ohio, you gotta go to Ohio and you have to see, the Supreme Court facilities there. They're absolutely phenomenal. So, if you have not been to the Supreme Court, any of you, please take the time to come to the Supreme Court. We can arrange for a tour. We can do that with a group. We can do that with you individually. We can do that with your families, just so you can have that advantage, too, because it is a special place to work, and we very much enjoy it. I'm very proud of it. And there's only last two items. We're making progress in certifying specialized dockets. Out of the 159 specialized dockets in the state, 86 have received final certification by the commission, 70 have been initially certified, and 3 are under initial review process. So that takes care of all 159. And that, I think, is extremely encouraging, and it's a great step forward. As I told you last year, we're working on language to reinstate the acting judge. We were last year working on language to reinstate the acting judge reimbursement. It was pulled from the budget bill, but we found a vehicle for it in the recent Court of Claims legislation. So House Bill 261, which took effect July 10th, reestablishes the Supreme Court's authority to reimburse local courts for the cost of using an acting judge. The legislation also gives the Supreme Court greater oversight on the use of those acting judges. Supreme Court staff is currently working on processes to make it make submission of an affidavit by the acting judge as simple as possible. Make no mistake, though, as of July 10th, the funding authority can seek reimbursement from the court for the use of an acting judge. And it was something that I talked about when I first became Chief Justice. It's taken this long to get it through the legislature, but it is through. It is now a reality, and we have reestablished the fund for acting judges. I'm pretty proud of that. So thank you for allowing me time to speak with you today. And again, thank you for all you do each and every day to provide service to the courts, service to the public in your communities, and to the profession. I think you all have a lot to be proud of, and I wish you all the best. God bless. Thank you.